Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I'm net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. For more than 44 years now, we've all been sitting in front of our radios every Sunday night at 8 p.m. and exchanging information, learning from each other, teaching each other, and hopefully entertaining each other. And I thank you once again for joining me this Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do it all over again. Let me drop for a second, and I will give you the usual links. If you would like to reach me via email for TechNet puzzles, for volunteering to discuss some new technology that just made it into the news that you're well aware of, or if you just want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and have him take a look at something NASA space-related, my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Of course, you can directly contact Paul. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. Also, we have a link page of interesting articles and YouTube videos that I've seen throughout the week. I cut and paste them, put them on a link page, and you can obtain it any time that you want. They're up 24/7. Just type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you my link page. We also have a chat room available. Sometimes it's busy, sometimes it's quiet. You can get to it by typing into your browser, chat.ac2gs.com. We also offer an audio stream on the Internet of the Technical Net. We keep it live the rest of the week because people ask me to, so you can listen into Glen Oaks without a handy talkie, without a radio, without an antenna, just an Internet connection alone. Just type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll get you into the audio stream of the Glen Oaks repeater. Also, I like to remind people that Mike, KC2NJI, has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv. It has seen more than 1 million visitors. It is the archive of the Limark Technical Net. Their archives go as far back as September of 2006. So avail yourself of the wisdom of people who've either moved away from the area or unfortunately become silent keys over the years. A lot of wisdom in those audio tapes. Anyway, let me drop for a second and I'll tell you what we got planned for tonight. We got a standard operating TechNet tonight, no guest speakers. I do have a couple of short comments about artificial intelligence to keep you up to date on the vicissitudes of such things. Then we will go to our main segment where we ask people to submit questions, comments, or topics for discussion. I ask people to hit the push to talk, ID themselves, give me your call sign, your first name, and whether it's amateur radio related or just science and technology, because we would prefer having the first few questions amateur radio related, but, we are open to any conversation about science and technology. That should take us approximately to 10:15, and Paul will join us for the SpaceNet Report, W2N. The SpaceNet Report should conclude around 11 o'clock p.m. I will return to tie a bow on everything and wish you well for the coming week. So that's the plan. If the repeater behaves itself and my check behaves itself and I don't get kicked off of All-Star too many times. So that's the plan for tonight. So let me drop for a second and I'll give you a real short comment about what's new in artificial intelligence. There really isn't a great deal to talk about tonight. OpenAI has released what they call Sora 2. It's an upgrade of their artificial intelligence video, movie generator. You put a prompt in and you get a short segment of moving pictures. Unfortunately, in its original form, it had no copyright limitations, so you could violate the copyright of Disney and all manner of large multi-billion dollar companies. And they complained, and OpenAI shut down the copyright well, turned on the copyright recognition, so you can no longer make movies of famous copyrighted characters. So that's the big news for this week, which only goes to show you that there's not really that much news going on in AI. There's still talk about the bubble. There's other talks about how NVIDIA has colluded with the AI companies to kind of rotate their funds to make it seem as though there's more investment dollars than there really is. They're just kind of moving the currency back and forth is the accusation. It's totally unproven, but that's what's in the news. So those are the items about artificial intelligence. If anyone wants to make any kind of a comment on any of that, please hit that push to talk. Yeah, Rich?
I have some AI news. I discovered an AI noise filter called RM Noise. And what you do is you take a 30-minute noise print, you record a 30-minute noise print of the noise that's coming into your receiver, you send it up to their servers, and then right after you send it up to their servers, you can listen to whatever band the noise print is from. You can listen through your computer to, let's say, 40 meters, and it makes a huge difference. It really does cut out the noise. But it's only cutting out, how would I say it, natural noise. It doesn't cut out QRM or, static crashes. It just lowers your noise floor by a good S3, S4 units. It's really amazing. I did a whole search on YouTube about guys who are demonstrating how it cuts noise, and it's pretty amazing. I sent that video to you, Roy. Did you get it?
No. When did you send that?
I don't know, about Wednesday or so?
Well, I'll rummage around for it. It sounds interesting, but it sounds like it's not particularly... It hasn't been trained on radio sounds. It's just a generic noise filter. There are a lot of somewhat generic AI-based noise filters in the audio community. There are a ridiculous number of plugins for audio devices. So I'll have to take a look at that. I kind of doubt that it's going to be 3S units of the noise floor removed. Because, mine is S5, so they would take it from S5 to S2. I would tend to doubt. Some of the noise artifacts will be diminished, I would assume. But I'll check it out, and I'll talk about it next week. Thanks for letting me know, Rich. What would be fantastic, two things. If they trained it for actual... amateur radio band. So all the other aspects of rubbish and noise might be removed, and especially if they could somehow rig it to be a real-time filter, that would make things amazing.
It's a real-time filter, and they do train it on the ham bands. That's why you have to record a half hour of the noise that you're hearing, and you save it to a file and send it up to their servers. So it is doing all that, Roy.
No, it isn't. That's not what real time is. Real time is you feed in the audio, and with only something like a latency delay, you get the filtered response. Having to record X number of minutes, sending it up to a server, and then having to then replay those X number of minutes is not real time. You know, there's a big difference between a latency error of 300 milliseconds and a latency error effectively of 15 minutes.
No, you're listening. You can have a QSO using this filter. You know, it's just that you're hearing the band through your computer, not through your radio. You hook a computer up to your radio, you take the noise print, you send it to their servers, and then you go on and have QSOs with a lesser noise floor. That's the way it works. RM Noise, it's called. Roger Mary Noise.
Okay, with that, I'll check it out. When you first described it, it sounded like you had to send the audio to their server, and then they processed the audio, and you could play it back and listen to it. Now it sounds like you just have to give it a noise print, and then you can have some kind of direct connection where it doesn't delay the audio?
Correct. It doesn't delay the audio at all. You can, as I say, you can have a QSO with it. Doesn't delay the audio at all.
But where are you listening to the audio? You're feeding the audio into your computer. Is it playing the audio immediately back through your computer?
It's playing the audio from your radio into your computer immediately.
Okay, but I'm asking about the computer to your audio listening to it. So it would have to take the input from your radio to the server, and then have another audio device playing the server's output with next to no latency error?
Latency error is like milliseconds. Milliseconds. I forgot the exact figure, but it's milliseconds, the error, the latency.
Impossible.
Okay, I'll have to check it out. Did someone want to say something? Okay, I guess I was just listening to an echo. It's RM Noise. I'll check it out again. It sounds vaguely familiar, like I've heard it before, but I don't know if I tinkered around with it. Again, there are a lot of, I know Audacity, which is a free audio recording software, and does a lot of other things, and I've been using it for many, many years, using it right now, has plugins, and some of the plugins do all kinds of interesting things. There's a plugin that does transcription for free. So in other words, I could take the entire audio file of this technical net, run it through this plugin, and in about 10, 15, 20 minutes the most, depending upon how many hours of audio, it spits out a transcript. So it's sort of amazing, open source and free AI plugins that have started to be developed. I'm looking forward to much more sophisticated. But once again, thank you, Rich. I appreciate that. I thank you for the knowledge. I'm always looking for new and interesting things.
All right. It's been around, I think, since 2023. So it's not brand new. It's been around for a couple of years.
Yeah, I, like I said, I think I've heard of it, but I don't remember, you know, how much I involved myself in tinkering with it. So I'll take a deeper look, because I really didn't remember that it was a real-time thing. It was, as far as I recall, but, you know, could be wrong or it could have changed. These things start out doing one thing and end up doing something completely different. So once again, thanks, and hopefully, if I recall, next Sunday night I'll insert a little comment to whether I thought it was great or mediocre or what have you, and hopefully it'll be another resource for our fellow hams. I mean, if it decreases the noise floor of 3S units, that's magical.
Well, when you look at these videos of ham radio operators trying it, It does seem pretty magical. I would say that if it works the way I saw on about three or four separate videos that it worked, I would use it all the time. The only thing I don't like is having to listen through my computer because I just have a laptop.
Right. I mean, as I've mentioned before, YouTube is a double-edged sword. Some things are very, very useful. Some of the people are brilliant, and others are far less useful, and some of the people are delusional. So we'll see. I've seen more than a few applications presented on YouTube, and when I pull them off and start to play with them, have become very, very disenchanted by the reality of them. So, you know, you always have to take YouTube with a grain of salt. It's a great resource, but it's uncurated. So, you know, you could have Albert Einstein do a presentation, and you could have Elmer Fudd do a presentation.
Excuse me, Einstein.
Yeah, I would take Einstein, too, but unfortunately, they don't label people. I once saw a YouTube of an auto mechanic who had decided to do a YouTube explaining Hall effect transistors without knowing how Hall effect transistors work. So he basically made up the whole premise and presented it like it was real. There's no one in YouTube that says, nah, that's naughty. You don't know what you're talking about, you know. They just let it ride unless someone kind of complains that you're saying racist things or warmongering things, and, you know, even that's questionable. So, every time I go into YouTube, I'm thankful for its existence. I can't see the titles that they put on things because the titles seldom have a lot to do with what the substance is, especially anything related to economics or politics or even events. Occasionally, they'll present a heartfelt, reminiscence of someone they said who has passed away recently, and when you look it up, they're perfectly alive. So, okay, we'll see. Any other comments before we move on? Okey-doke, we're open for business. If you have any questions or comments or topic for discussion, please hit that push to talk. Give me your first name, your call sign, whether it's amateur radio related or science and technology, and we'll put you on the list.
Alpha to Echo 2, Yankee Golf.
DC.
Sam and Rich recognize. Anyone else want to put their name on the list? Okay. Hopefully, as the night progresses, people will wander in a little on the late side, put their name on the list, and we'll have more questions or comments, or someone sitting back, relaxing, staring at the radio, will pop an idea into their head of a question or a comment or a topic for discussion. So you're up first, Sam, tonight. What you got for us?
Thank you, Roy, and thank you, Rich. And I'd like to discuss grounding because I'm a bit confused. I have a couple of questions, so let me start with the first one. I have a couple of antennas, and I'm using antenna switches. I bought the Delta Alpha switch, and then I bought some cheap ones. And someone advised me I should stay with the Delta Alpha switches for coax because they have some built-in lightning protection. Do you agree that it's worthwhile to spend the extra money for Delta Alpha coax switches as opposed to less expensive switches? Back to you, Roy.
AC2GS. I think they're Alpha Delta. I own a bunch of them. I like them a lot. My rationale was not solely that they have built-in lightning protection if you properly ground them. It's not that important to have that type of protection or a switch that's inside your shack. You want to really protect from lightning before it gets inside your shack. But I like that they're very well built and dependable and high quality. So I have a whole bunch of Alpha Delta switches. So you know, it's a couple of bucks more, but I don't have a problem paying for quality. You know, paying for nothing or paying for a brand name, I do have a problem with. But they actually put some of the money into the manufacturing of the of these antenna switches. So yeah, I think it's a good product, and I own some.
Thank you, Roy. Okay, I agree with your analysis, and that ends that question. Now comes the bigger question about grounding. And, of course, my situation is my shack is on the top floor of a three-story brownstone, and my antennas are, of course, on the roof. And I was told that if I ran a grounding rod into the ground and I ran a wire up the side of that brownstone to my shack to ground my rigs. And then I was advised, well, it's not going to work because being 30 feet away from the grounding rod is worthless, and I'm actually increasing the antennas of my system by doing that. So the real question is, how do I ground my equipment on the third floor of a brownstone? Back to you, Roy. Alpha Echo 2, Yankee Golf.
Okay, so you ground discharge probably static electricity and for lightning protection. I kind of touched on this a month or so ago, but a wire is a problematic thing because the wires act as inductors. The longer the wire, the more inductance. The more inductance, the more impedance. The more impedance is that you're kind of blocking the current flow that you don't want. You want the current flow to be maximum. So you somehow have to either figure out something completely different, or you have to figure out how to have a piece of wire have the lowest possible inductance. And usually the way that people do that is rather than using a regular wire, they use the strapping, which is, you know, sheets of metal, you know, of a given, width. You know, some are half inch, some are inch, some are inch and a half. You wouldn't particularly want the braided types of flat grounding straps because they're made of stranded copper, and if you leave them in open areas where weather and they get wet, you'll get some corrosion, and that will kind of diminish the benefits. So inside your shack, braided grounding straps are great because they're very flexible, and because they're inside your house, your inside house doesn't rain or snow or anything, so you don't really worry about weatherproofing it. So for the inside of the house, copper strapping, braided copper strapping. For outside the house, most people suggest copper strapping anywhere from an inch to 2 inches. Will it completely get rid of all the inductance? No. It will lessen the inductance so that the resistance, the impedance actually, won't be as bad as if you use the regular simple piece of wire. Some people, especially there are establishments, you know, where they're at the top of an apartment complex, they float their ground. They do not hook it up to a proper ground, and a lot of them get away with it. You know, if you get away with it, it's great, but it's kind of the matter of the belt and suspenders. I'm willing to bet that there's loads of people listening tonight who have yet to get around to grounding their system. They thought about doing it, and they're going to do it one of these days, but they haven't done it yet. And because most of us don't particularly live in high-lying environments, there are some areas of Long Island that are, we're able to get away with things. So I hope that helps, but if you have any other question or something I said doesn't make sense, feel free.
Alpha Echo 2, Yankee Golf, Sam. No, that's very helpful. So basically I'll run a 30-foot copper strap
my grounding rod to my rigs upstairs, and upstairs I'll use the braided copper between the units. Now, someone also suggested, I saw this on a YouTube that was actually posted to the Kings County Radio Club Facebook page, which says that you should wrap a ballon or choke around the coax cables. Actually, they're inside the shack going to the various rigs. So their suggestion was use chokes or some chokes to on the actual cable to cut down the RF. What's your opinion of that?
Well, my attitude is that RF chokes are relatively inexpensive and there's no such thing as too many chokes. You know, if you put 150 chokes on your line, the only thing that might happen is you run out of space to actually sit in the room. But, you know, taking a belt suspenders type of an attitude and putting an RF choke in every little insertion that you have, you know, it can be helpful. It may be incidental. It may make absolutely no difference. But it's a relatively cheap and easy thing to do, and you can't have too many RF chokes. So I have loads of ferrite toroids, and I even have these things that I think it's Palomar cells that are RF chokes in a little weatherproof chassis. And I put them outside of the house, and I put the ferrites inside the house. And if I ever have any problems, I'll put a second one next to the first one. Like I said, there's no real problem as far as just RF choking. We've talked in the past that some antennas require a counterpoise, and if you apply excessive amounts of RF chokes, you limit what your antenna can use for a counterpoise, and that might have a negative effect on the antenna performance. But simply as a choke for common mode RF getting into your house, into your shack, you can never have too many.
Thank you, Roy. And I have one more question, and that is... Oh, actually two. One, what happens if you don't ground your equipment at all? You plug it into the wall, you plug in the antenna, and you start hamming. What's the effect of not having a ground attached to the rigs at all? That's one question. And the second one, let me just think for a second because it went out of my head, lightning. Does this help? Using these outside ground coming up the side of the building, does this have any positive effect in terms of negating the dangers of lightning? How would you deal with the lightning issue? Back to you, Roy. That's the end of my questions for this evening.
AC2GS. Okay, I'll answer the second question first, just for the heck of it. So you're talking about lightning protection. Lighting protection is very iffy. You can offer a suggestion to the lightning bolt of where you would like it to go, preferably continue to go outside of your apartment and not inside and then outside again, where it could wreak havoc with everything you own. You can give that suggestion, but ultimately it's sort of up to the lightning where it decides is its easiest easiest path to ground potential. So, and of course, if you don't live in a particularly risky lightning environment, not grounding your antenna system the way you mentioned in the first question, it'll never come up because, you know, best case scenario as opposed to worst case scenario. With worst case scenario is if lightning strikes your antenna, you want to give it the best path that's the least destructive to you, which is to keep it outside of your shack and not to get inside your shack. And so that's what a lightning protection tends to be. It's a little spark gap that's attached to earth ground. Sometimes it's sufficient to deter the lightning bolt, but other times it'll just spray out and wreak havoc in your house no matter what you can do. So nothing is a guarantee. You're just kind of hedging your bets and improving your probabilities a little bit. So that's question two. Question one is, what happens if you just float your ground and effectively not grounding yourself? Again, a lot of people actually do that. A lot of people either get away with it entirely or don't realize that some of their problems are based on having done that. By not grounding your system, you put yourself at a greater chance of static electrical discharges producing extra noise in your receiver's front end and diminishing your ability to receive signals. You know, things like that. And to a degree, again, the lightning and electrical discharge potentials getting into your equipment and such. Again, a lot of people float their grounds and never have a problem. Other people, even if they do everything possible, will have a nearby lightning strike that induces currents through their outlets, through the utility electricity, and they don't particularly blow their radios from the antenna input, they blow them from the power supply. So sometimes you're lucky, sometimes you're not. You know, again, a lot of people get away with floating their grounds, and they live to tell the story.
Is the ferrite on the coax cables inside the house resolve some of the static electricity problem?
It can. It can deal with static electricity. It could also deal with, it's not at all uncommon for RF to get into the microphone input and distort your audio. So, you know, a lot of people tell their friends to before they can buy a ferrite torus, they tell them to take some of the microphone cable and loop it around a few times, you know, turn it into a poor man's inductor, a poor man's ugly RF chip. For both RF getting into different aspects of your equipment and static electricity, ferrite RF choke can be beneficial. It's, again, not a binary one and zero. You may have not had enough impedance so that you'll still have some problems with RF getting into your microphone input, but a lot less than you had when you first put your first RF choke in line.
Does this have an effect on SWR?
No, it shouldn't have any effect on SWR other than if you use these RF chokes to screw around with the antenna's counterpoise. Then it will affect the SWR. But purely, you know, if you have an antenna tuner or whatever, and you start putting, 25 ferrite toruses in line with its output, it's not going to change the SWR reading on your antenna tuner.
Roy, thank you very much. You've been extremely helpful, as always. Back to you and Annette, and I'll be listening. Thank you.
Great. You're welcome, Sam. Anytime. Thank you for participating in our lovely little technical mess. Anyone with any comments before we move on to the next person?
AB2DU.
Yes, Alex?
I've seen on some videos where if you have a small vertical antenna, you've got, you know, 8 or 10 little slots where the counterpoise wires can radiate out from the bottom. I've seen some people take one of those and tie it to a ground rod. Is that a best practice? And what's the difference between having, if you're doing POTA, just 10 counterpoises versus 9 counterpoises and then one tied into the ground rod or nailed into the beach?
Okay, let's take this in little fragments. Part of your question is, what's with the counterpoises? Although usually, most times, configured the counterpoises, they call them radials. They know they're working as counterpoises. The fact of what's the magic number for a counterpoise is one of those things you'll never find definitively in any textbook. You'll find a lot of stuff on the internet and YouTube of people saying that there is an exact number. Like I've heard for ground-based verticals, the magic number for radials is 36. And if you look for what length they're supposed to be, if you're looking for the most likely answer, the most likely answer will be a quarter of a wavelength. But you'll get people who say almost every number known to the mankind and every length known to mankind. So, again, it's not in the textbook. There's no equation for it. It's, you know, it's whatever works for you. Forward to the question of is it best practice and better to have one of your radials grounded? Not necessarily, but, you know, sometimes, especially some circumstances, grounding one of your radials will give you some protection against static electricity and other things. So it might be marginally better than just the wire is just kind of hanging out at the surface of the ground. But, you know, almost no one I know kind of does that with a radial. Sometimes they will, especially with a NFED half wave, with a UNUN that has a connection that says ground. That's usually used for a counterpoise, but I've seen a lot of guys insert it into a ground. I don't know whether the ground is doing that much or just the length of the counterpoise that got it to the ground. But, I mean, it could be beneficial under some circumstances. So I'm sorry if it sounds like I'm waffling, but, you know, the laws of physics often waffle.
Yeah, I think it's helpful information. I was just always confused, you know, because you see some guys going to great lengths to elevate the radial and then to just nail one of them into the ground anyway. I didn't know why you bother elevating the rest of them, but maybe it's just a totally different thing.
Well, usually you want to elevate the radials because you require far less radials from an elevated system than from a ground-based system. A ground-based system, you have to concern yourself with the immediate coupling of the radials with the ground, which leads to a lot of waste energy instead of being dissipated as radio waves. They're dissipated as heat loss in the soil, and they warm the worms. So the worms get happy, but your efficiency of your antenna is undermined. So by raising it a bit of distance away from the ground, you can get away with going from 36 radials that I mentioned as the optimum to 3 radials. If you look around, a lot of UHF, VHF verticals have these real short, stubby 3 radials, and that's all that they really need. You can get by on 2 also, but it's a little bit better for omnidirectional operation with 3. So that's kind of why you generally would prefer a vertical with elevated radials as opposed to mounting it smack on the ground.
Last add-on question. In real life, do people bother measuring the radials, or do you just wing it and fill your 10 slots with like 10, 15-foot wires and see if it's helpful and call it a day? Or do you target some magic length? AD2DU.
AC2GS. It depends. I hate to waffle on it again, but it depends. I mean, there are most practical, non-technical guys, just, you know, they have a piece of wire. The piece of wire is 12 and a half feet. They connect to 12 and a half feet, and they see what they get. And then they shorten it, and they see how that goes. And they shorten it, or they lengthen it, and see how that goes. There are guys out there who are obsessive-compulsive. They still own a slide rule when they were that they bought when they were kids. and they will measure exactly something, often one-quarter wavelength for the resonant frequency they're working on. Some of them who are building verticals that are multi-band will have multiple lengths of radials, you know, each representing something like a quarter wavelength of one of the antenna, one of the resonant frequencies. So it sort of depends. I think the overall majority of amateur radio operators tend to wing it. There are a lot more guys who are just kind of doing things and seeing how it works rather than, you know, doing scientific search in the field. But, you know, if you pick up a good magazine, technical magazine, inevitably, occasionally, there will be articles of, you know, how many radials are best. You know, when do you reach diminishing returns and what's the optimal length? And those guys measure it to the 16th of an inch, most likely.
Great. Thank you for the information, Roy. I'm always usually on team wing it because who's got the time to do math rather than operate? But helpful info. Thank you.
I agree. You're welcome. And thank you for participating. As always, I do appreciate it. Rich, what do you got for us tonight?
First, on the noise front, there's a YouTube video called Hunting Down Power Line Noise and Other RFI, and it's by AWA Communication Technologies Museum. It's an hour long, so it's really a deep dive into it. There's another one, and I want to see if I could get it really quick. Maybe not. But hold on just 1 second. Okay. I'll get it before the TechNet's over. Okay, I'm going to bring up something that we've talked about 100 times before, but I still don't understand. Here's the other video. It's Jeff W4DD Delta Delta presentation of RFI, and it's the East Coast Reflector channel. It's Jeff W4DD, and that's an hour and 34 minutes. So it's another deep dive. Anyway, on to. Okay. I am still confused about how my internal antenna tuner and my external antenna tuner work together. And here's where the confusion comes in. Say I have the internal tuner. I cannot bypass my external tuner without unplugging it and rewiring everything. It doesn't have a bypass switch. So it's always in the circuit, my external antenna tuner. Let me let it drop a second. Okay. My internal antenna tuner, I could push a button and have it in the circuit, or not push a button and only have the external antenna tuner in the circuit. But here's what I don't understand. Let's say I have both activated, both the external and the internal tuners working. And let's say it comes up with an SWR of, just for argument's sake, of 2-1. When I take the internal antenna tuner out of the circuit, if I deactivate it, the SWR will probably go up to like 3.5-1. But then I can use the external antenna tuner controls to get it back down to what it was with the internal antenna tuner in the circuit to about a 2-to-1. Okay, so my question is, should I not use both together, and if not, why not? Why not? What is it doing by using both of them together? That's my question. Go ahead, Bert.
Okay, we've kind of had this conversation a few times, but I'm more than happy to do it one more time. It sort of depends. I mean, it's considered bad practice to run two auto-matching antenna tuners simultaneously in line, because depending upon how their algorithms are programmed, they're designed to adjust to transform their impedance to 50 ohms or as close as possible and then stop. But if you sometimes have two differing programs on two differing antenna tuners, they fight with each other. They'll overshoot, and the other one will undershoot, and then they'll undershoot, and then the other one will overshoot, and they'll get into a kind of feedback frenzy. It might not be in your case, but it has been known to happen, and most people suggest that if you can transform your impedances with one antenna tuner, do use one, don't use two. Another thing to consider for using more than one antenna tuner is that they all have their own attenuation losses. They are not lossless devices. And so you're going to have more losses using two of them than you would if you just use one. And if you can transform the impedance correctly using purely one, you're ahead of the game because you have less total insertion loss based on just the electronics that you haven't bought your antenna tuners from JPL using silver and superconducting materials that are lossless.
But if I'm ending up getting the same SWR, whether I use one or both, why does it make a difference?
Again, because there is a non-zero insertion loss in both of your antenna tuners, and if you use both of them, you get more insertion loss. That might not reflect your standing wave ratio, but it will limit the amount of current that you can transfer to your antenna. It might not lot of attenuation loss, but again, it's not zero. So, you know, to use an extra box that's unnecessary for a unknown but not zero power loss isn't particularly a great idea, generally speaking. So, I mean, I can't tell you exactly how much loss you'll get, but you'll have some loss because physical objects all have insertion losses. It's very difficult, other than using superconducting materials, to accomplish elsewhere otherwise.
So are you saying I should be getting a lower signal report if I'm using both tuners than if I'm using one or the other?
Theoretically, yes, but in practical terms, probably not. Again, we talked about how you have to basically have an attenuation loss of 75%, which is not going to happen, in order for it to drop one S unit. So, you know, it's very likely that the amount of attenuation loss is going to end up looking like, say, 1/100th of an S unit. I don't know about you, but I can't make out 1/100th of an S unit on my receivers. So it will look perfectly similar to me.
So the answer is probably it really has no effect whether you use two or one. Now, it's much easier for me to use both of them because I just hit tune on the ICOM and it's supposed to tune the external antenna tuner. It's supposed to be an automatic antenna tuner, but unless I manually futz around with the external antenna tuner, I really can't get as low an SWR reading as if I'm just, The case with me is I can never not use my external antenna tuner, because like I say, the only way to take it out of the circuit is to, you know, unplug it, the power cord, and also unplug the coax from it, and then replug the coax from the antenna straight into the radio. And believe me, I'm not going to do that every time I switch bands. So it just doesn't seem to me that there's really any inherent difference. Now, because it's best practices, and that's what I've always heard, I use both of them to get the SWR to a certain point, and then, and only then, do I take the internal antenna tuner out of the circuit and tweak the external antenna tuner to get the lowest SWR. So when I'm finally finished, I'm just using the external SWR, but I don't think it matters.
Well, I hopefully you understand what I kind of told you about the theoretical base of the insertion loss and the possibility of automated antenna tuners battling it out forever and ever. It's good practices to use one. If you use two or three or seven or 12, the FCC will not knock on your door, will not give you any trouble whatsoever. If you advise other hams in earshot of other amateur radio operators who think they know what they know, you might get looked askance, but that's about the worst punishment you'll get. You know, I don't know. My antenna tuners all have bypass mode, so I'm not quite sure what brand doesn't even give you a bypass mode. You know, it's one of those things that kind of is almost a given of many of them. But, you know, again, if the situation for you warrants using more than one, so be it. I would advise against generally telling everyone to that, and under special situations, it's fine to tell people because, you know, everyone is different. But, you know, fundamentally, you know, if there was a big question on the FCC exam about what's the best number of antenna tuners to put in line and run simultaneously, you should answer one, even if you used to.
The only time I use two is if I don't have time to just tweak the SWR with the external antenna tuner, because, let's say I switch bands and I hear somebody I want to reply to right away, I push the internal antenna tuner button, and it tunes. Now it's tuning both, or it's activating both the internal tuner and the external tuner. When I push the tune button on the radio, and that's because it's supposed to be an automatic antenna tuner. So it does make a difference. It you can hear the relays moving when I just push the internal antenna tuner. It's working with the external tuner. It's not battling back and forth. You know, it gets everything into tune within a second or two. I've never had it try to tune longer than that. You know, I've never even had it try to tune for 2 seconds. It's only like 1 second, 1.5 seconds, and the thing's in tune, or the lowest SWR appears. So, but as I say, I do 90% of the time only use the external antenna tuner, and not both of them. But again, I don't think it matters.
Again, no one's going to ticket you. You know, there might be some people who cast aspersions. That's the worst thing. And if it works for you, then do it. But again, if some guy who just started out in the hobby is asking if it's a good idea to string some antenna tuners together serially, you know, the optimum answer is, under most circumstances, no, it won't. But again, you can do anything you like. You won't get a ticket. You won't get arrested. You won't get an article in the New York Post, telling people about the terrible crime that you undertook.
One test I haven't done is ask somebody on the other side who I'm in a CUSO with if they could stand by and let me take out the internal antenna tuner and then tweak the external antenna tuner if they notice any difference in my signal. I haven't ever done that, but I'm pretty sure I know the answer. Because, as I say, when I find myself in a situation where I have to use both of them, stations are still coming back to me and giving me, you know, the 5.7, 5.9 reports that I hear when only my external antenna tuner is activated. So, I guess that sort of muddles the picture more, because there's really no definitive way to measure what the insertion loss is doing to my signal on the other end.
But no, there really isn't. Even if you just hook up a watt meter, because there are so many other little variables going on, and because the amount of insertion loss is not zero, but nowhere close to 1%, you wouldn't be able to really perceive it. You know, the watt meters are plus or minus 5%. So, you know, all these things are out of specs for something as minuscule. So, like I said, on a theoretical basis, you are taking a hit due to insertion loss, but that insertion loss is so small that it's not going to have any kind of profound effect on your signal whatsoever.
You know, I wonder if ICOM has ever published what the insertion loss is by using their internal tuner. Do you think they have? Probably not.
Okay, I would be willing.
Knowledge?
Oh, hello, Brian. We'll get to you in a second. I seriously doubt that they measured it, that they would publish it. Again, because it's not going to have any kind of significant effect. You know, I mean, any kind of insertion loss that would have a significant effect would be the most impractical, worthless antenna tuner known to mankind. I mean, there are devices that sort of mimic that type of approach. An antenna manufacturer sells an antenna as a multiband with a very low SWR and puts in a ballon that is ridiculously inefficient. So that usually your SW meter calculates SWR based upon your forward and reflected currents. And if you have a very lossy ballon, you don't get too much return current. So it seems incorrectly that your SWR is as close to one as possible. So, but that's an antenna and that's a ballon that does that, not an antenna tuner. That was kind of just the purpose of a good antenna tuner. So, unfortunately, there's a lot of things that people would like to have published with antenna tuners. Dick K2RIW regularly discussed that he would have loved it if the manufacturer had offered him a Smith chart demonstrating the range of impedance matches that an antenna tuner is capable of. You know, when they publish that it's 3-to-1 or 10-to-1, that's a real rough approximation. The only way to real fundamentally tell people what kind of impedance they could match is by publishing a proper Smith chart. But they don't want to be bothered, and most consumers don't know how to read a Smith chart, so there isn't that much of a demand.
Most modern transceivers say that their tuners could only handle 3-to-1. which is the case with my 7300. My Zygu, though, can handle almost, 11 to 1. It has a legendary antenna.